Today's guest is described as an unapologetically out lesbian with extensive history of leadership in the LGBTQ community. We'll meet her in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to introduce to you Sheila Alexander Reed, who is the Director of LGBTQ Affairs for the Mayor's Office of Washington, D.C. Sheila, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Sheila, for those who don't know what LGBTQ stands for, would you tell us?
Sure. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer / questioning affairs is the name of my office.
Okay. And if you would, give us a sense of what an average day is like in your office. You're in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Lots of interesting things are going on in the world today as a result of where you are and who's there with you. Give me an average day. Is there an average day?
Not really, but I can give you a sense of what I do most of the time.
Okay.
Every day is different, and so when you're responding to residents' needs, you know, their needs are going to be different, and so your work is going to be different. But what we do in general is ensure that the community understands the mayor's vision for the District of Columbia and ensure that the mayor knows the community's needs as well. So that's sort of the overarching sort of goal. But on a day-to-day level, we help homeless LGBTQ youth find housing. We make sure that residents who may be feeling discriminated against based on their sexual orientation or gender identity are connected to the Office of Human Rights, because D.C. has really strong protections in their Human Rights Act that include sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression. And, you know, in a nutshell, we make sure that the residents have access to all the government resources that anybody else has. And so that could be setting up a business, that could be, you know, dealing with a property tax, that could be getting your trash picked up. It's dealing with constituent services and needs.
You just said that really your job is to help residents in whatever way they need help. So given that sort of broad overview, why is there a need for an office specifically devoted to serving the LGBTQ community?
Well, there are several offices like mine that sort of like work with specific communities that have sort of nuanced needs and particular disparities or particular sort of issues that may come up. And so you want somebody who is versed in those nuances and needs to address them. So I will talk about there may be a particular health need, there may be a particular business need, there may be a particular public safety need, there may be a particular need regarding housing or employment. So you want to make sure you have somebody competent and you know, when possible, I think, you know, respected by that community and a member of that community to make sure that, you know, that their needs are met.
You use the term nuanced needs. A few moments ago, you were talking, giving us an example of some of the things that you do, and one of the things that you indicated was helping homeless LGBTQ youth. Many times, at least from my awareness, LGBTQ youth are homeless because they have come out to their families. Their families have said, oh, no, it isn't so, and then literally kick them out of the house. Is that what you're finding, or are there other issues around homelessness for the youth?
That is the primary reason. If your family doesn't agree with your, it could be, again, sexual orientation, gender identity, which is different from sexual orientation. You may be transitioning from male to female or female to male. because your gender identity, you know, is such that you identify with a gender that's not what the doctor assigned at birth. So your family may have a problem with that. They may be religious, or they just may not understand. Also, gender expression can be one of the reasons why a youth may be kicked out of their home. They may not dress according to the gender that they were assigned at birth, and so their family may have a problem with that. I mean, it starts with, it could be a problem at school. It could be a problem with your family's church. It could just be a family member in general, but it is usually family related, and sometimes a child may be kicked out. Sometimes a child may run away from home if it's not a safe space. So whatever the reason, you know, they need assistance, and we help with emergency housing. We help with transitional housing, which is a way that they may be in an 18-month program where they're housed, kind of like a pseudo independent living, but they get 18 months in there, either in school or in employment. And so that enables them to get some stability. And then ultimately, you know, you want to see them transfer to permanent housing.
One of the questions that I would ask of you, you know that here at Mind Talk, we talk about relationships and mental health. And I'm thinking about the impact of the emotional well-being on that youth who has been removed, thrown out of their home for reasons that they didn't create. How that impacts the youth and what you might say to the parents.
Well, it puts that youth at risk. Let me just point that out, because when you don't have support at home, you're going to look for it elsewhere. And sometimes that outside support doesn't have your best welfare in mind. So it really makes you sort of at risk to be preyed upon. It puts you at usually results in some sort of depression. And imagine being homeless and depressed. And usually if you're young, you probably don't have any skill sets to be employed. And so really you're at the mercy of others. And I think that that has an impact on your self-esteem and ultimately your welfare. And so what we do is, you know, you want to make sure that we don't want to put anybody back in their home if it's not a safe and supportive space. So I think first we do is get them off the street. And that's what the emergency beds are for. And then, you know, it should be assigned a caseworker to look into their situation. But what I will say is, if I have the opportunity to talk to a parent, I will say that, you know, just as your sexual orientation wasn't a choice, your child's sexual orientation isn't their choice. And just as your gender identity wasn't a choice, their gender identity isn't a choice. And at the end of the day, nobody would put themselves through this, I would say, this situation of being estranged from their family, being bullied at school, being terrorized on the streets. Nobody would put themselves through that experience unless they were actually you know, feeling that was their true identity and that their true expression, because it is putting yourself at risk in many instances. And so I try to explain it that way. So it's not a blame game, and it's not a religious conversation. It's sort of like a heart-to-heart conversation. You know your child, and hopefully you love your child. And so I would say, get to know your child and try to have a conversation and understand. understand why they feel the way they feel, and understand that this is not have anything to do with you. A lot of parents think they've done something wrong, or their child has done something wrong. And neither one of those is true. This child is just trying to be themselves, and what we would hope that as a parent you would do is support that child in the best way possible. If they came to you for help for another instance, you would help them. So just think of this as another sort of just regular need for help and support.
Just kind of part of the parenting process. Sheila Alexander Reed, the Director of LGBTQ Affairs for the Mayor's Office of Washington, D.C. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Sheila, you talked about homelessness for LGBTQ youth. You are also involved in a project that is specifically designed for the elderly. Why do elderly LGBTQ persons need housing, which is what you're dealing with, that is specifically geared towards them?
So what people don't realize is that a lot of the systems that are set up for the elderly are set up for heterosexual elders, and not really keeping in mind that a couple that may come into assisted living facility may be a same-sex couple, or maybe even a single person going to a facility may have a same-sex partner visiting them, or same-sex relationship, their child might be in a same-sex relationship. So a lot of these facilities have existed for years and were created, years ago when homosexuality was a crime. So I think what we found is that a lot of seniors have opted to go back in the closet in order to be accepted and to be even admitted into some of these facilities. And of course that takes a toll on your mental health. And not only that, but what does that do for the people who are unwilling to go back in the closet? Where will they go? So a lot of LGBT seniors are estranged from their families, or they may not have kids to rely on to take care of them in their old age. And so where would they go, particularly if they're not welcome at these assisted living facilities as they are, as their authentic selves? So they have to, decide, do they go back in the closet, or do they have to try to live on some sort of meager income that puts them living at substandard facilities and substandard levels of care. And I think that we shouldn't have to make that choice. I think that assisted living facilities and any kind of elderly care should be culturally competent, and they have to be brought up to speed and understand it's 2019. And there's a certain level of standards that everybody deserves, and seniors that are LGBTQ are no different than any other seniors.
You work clearly for the mayor's office here in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Are there similar offices across the country? Is your office unique?
We are unique in that D.C. is rated number one as far as protections and rights for the LGBTQ community. Hmm. But we are not the only office that works and for the mayor that represents the LGBTQ community. I think there's at least six that I know of, but there may be some that I don't know of. So I think these are becoming, I would say, more and more popular, depending on how strong a voice the community has in that jurisdiction. I think it starts off by making sure that you get officials that are elected that care about you and recognize that your community exists. And then it's much easier to say, well, we would like some representation at the highest level. Just like, you know, there's in D.C., we have an Office of Latino Affairs. We have Office of Asian Pacific Islander Affairs, Religious Affairs, Veterans Affairs. So why would not there be an LGBTQ Affairs? I mean, each one of those communities has unique needs that need to be addressed.
Are you saying that there are six or seven offices similar to yours across the country?
At least.
That's all?
At least.
That's it?
At least. There may be 10.
Wow.
If I was to guess, but it's still still like finding a unicorn. They're not very common.
It sounds like that. Let me ask you a question.
But you understand, D.C. has the largest LGBT self-identified community in the country. So it is a no-brainer that we should have this office here.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question. How mm-hmm. do you identify? Let me ask you a question about yourself. How do you identify? Are you African-American? Are you a woman? Are you a lesbian? When you look in the mirror, who do you
see? I would say yes to all three of those. I see an African-American lesbian.
And I
can't separate the three.
Okay.
Or the woman and the lesbian. I can't, and the African-American. I can't separate those three.
Each of those identities all by themselves certainly have experience and experience discrimination. So when you experience yourself as all three, what does that say about your exposure to discrimination?
That is the consummate definition of intersectionality, right? It's being discriminated against on multiple levels. On one level, you're already at a disadvantage for being a woman. It is this country is set up on a patriarchal model, so women are second class to men. There's that. And then you have the race issue. Black people are not considered on the same level as white people. And so that's so now you're also discriminated on that as well as the gender issue. And then you add another layer of sexual orientation in which while we have made a lot of inroads on gender bias and racial equity, you know, I would say we still got a long way to go as far as sexual orientation and really as far as all three. So that is the definition of intersectionality, is being discriminated against on multiple levels for different reasons, for different sort of issues. And so I see myself as somebody who is rather privileged, given the fact that I do have intersectional discrimination being placed upon me. I rise above it each and every day as best I can. And I go out and try to make the world a better place for others like me and for others who are not like me. I spend a lot of time talking to people about their privilege and getting them to understand their privilege and how to use their privilege for the good of those who do not have it. You know, a lot of work is done in the marginalized community, but you really have to speak to the privileged community as well to actually sort of have a meeting of the mind and to move the needle much faster.
How
I hope I answered your question. I don't even remember. You said, how do I wake up? I wake up as Sheila, the black lesbian, on a mission every day.
Every day. Mm-hmm. How different is the world for a white lesbian versus a black lesbian? Is it significantly different?
Well, I can't say for sure, but I dare say it is significantly different. You know, you can always hide the whole lesbian piece, but you know, I can't hide my black piece, right? So I can't go into the closet as far as being black. So that discrimination is coming at me from the minute I walk out of the door sometimes, based on just how I appear and how other people feel about that. I could, of course, hide my gayness, but I can't hide my race, and I can't. I would not hide my gender. So there's that. So I think that I think there's sort of like a totem pole, if you will, of hierarchy. I think it starts with white men, then white women, and then black men, and then black women, and then Latino men, and then Latino women. I would say I put Asian Pacific Islander somewhere in the middle, between probably black and white. But I do say that the black and brown women are at the bottom of the totem pole. And so that is something that that needs to be addressed. And that's something that, you know, we work hard to sort of set a level playing field each and every day. And then it is a struggle. But I think that D.C. is a model for what the world could look like if people are treated equally. And so that's what we're trying to, you know, take these rights that we have in D.C. and you know, make them work with national organizations so that this model can spread. You know, we have a black female mayor who's now serving a second term, which is unheard of in D.C. She's the first black female mayor to be reelected. And so I think that these are sort of the things that show you what is possible when you work hard and you dream big.
And when you turn to yourself, I would say, to pull out those resources and that energy that in a lot of ways and a lot of times in a lot of places others would seek to dampen. Sheila, we're going to take a break.
Yeah, I talk a lot about privilege, and I have to acknowledge my own each and every time as well.
Absolutely.
And that helps people see theirs.
That they don't have to be alone. Sheila, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer.
Thank you.
You are listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Sheila Alexander Reed, the Director of LGBTQ Affairs for the Mayor's Office of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. We'll be right back. Sheila, you are the founder of something called Women in the Life. What is that?
Women in the Life, LIFE. It's a black lesbian organization that I started in the 90s. It started off as a social event management company. And then it also included a magazine. We printed 96 issues of course, between 1993 and I believe 2003. And then after that, it segued into a nonprofit and became Women in Life Association, which is a social justice organization. So I went from social events to social justice. And now I am just on the board of the organization, but it kind of went down and became inactive for a few years and has since come back up when the current administration was elected into the White House.
And why was there...
Because we saw the need. Why? Because we saw a need for social justice like never before. You know, we saw a future where our rights may be rolled back, and I dare say that that vision is coming true, unfortunately, where we're seeing a lot of proposed ideologies that would take us back as far as being women, as far as being people of color, and as far as being members of the LGBTQ community. I mean, in some sense, I feel like, you know, we're under assault. And so I believe that that's why Women in the Life needed to come back. You know, I think when we got marriage equality, some people thought that, you know, we'd arrived and everything was going to be great from here on out, not anticipating the fact that when you get sort of movement on one side, there's usually some pushback, and I think that we're feeling the pushback now, and I think it caught a lot of people sleeping, and so Women in Life is sort of waking up the Black lesbian and Black queer women communities to say you need to stand up and speak out or you will be erased.
The idea of standing up and speaking out, and I take this back to those whose families have really isolated them from the family and maybe from the social environment connected to the family. The idea of standing up and speaking out on the one hand makes an incredible amount of sense on the and can actually add to one's self-concept. On the other hand, standing up and speaking out didn't serve them well with their family. How should they think about standing up and speaking out now?
At the end of the day, it's the type of thing, it's not something that everybody can afford to do. And I understand that. It's much like coming out, you know. I'm not the coming out police. I can't tell you when to come out. You have to come out when it's safe for you to come out. And just like that, you need to stand up and speak up when it's safe for you to come out, safe for you to speak out. However, if you can't speak out, I think there are other things that you can do to support those who are speaking out. So, and at some point, you have to ask yourself, what is it costing you when you don't speak out?
Yeah.
You know, when people are have to go back in the closet or in the closet or have to diminish themselves to make others feel good, that eats away at them a little bit at a time. And I think that's a cost that I dare say you really need to weigh and decide if it's worth it. And if you need help speaking out and speaking up and or coming out, there are resources that can help you.
Sheila, unfortunately, our time today has pretty much slipped away. But for those who would like to continue this conversation with you, is there a way for them to be in touch?
Sure. I'm here every day, 9 to 5. The Mayor's Office of LGBTQ Affairs is in Washington, D.C., but we have been contacted by other people from around the world who want to know about how we got, you know, to where we are as far as our rights and protections and how we can help others get there as well. The number to our office is 202-727-9493. Again, that's 202-727-9493. And our email is LGBTQ@dc.gov.
Okay. All right, Sheila.
Sorry.
That's perfectly fine. Thank you for the correction. I hope that we will be able to continue this conversation, but I do thank you so much for joining us today here on Mind Talk.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you as an educational public service. It is not intended to interfere or alter with any services that you may choose to use that are of use to you. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch, you can email me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.
Thank you.